Hi, this is Michelle Schuck, and you're listening to A Great Leap Forward on Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
I'm backstage at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz with Michelle Schacht. And
we just had a great show. It was a lot of fun. Y'all missed it.
There were a lot of people here.
Oh, well, listening to the... Oh, good. Well, we had fun, didn't we? Testify.
It was great. It was such a joyful show. Really, you're so joyful to watch. It looks like you're enjoying yourself so much.
It's nice to not have to go through the motions. I've managed to preserve a great deal of integrity, you know, with what I do and with what I say I do. I found life is a lot more enjoyable that way. There was a time I remember where I was being overworked early on, and you know, they were telling me things like go as far as you can because it's all going to be downhill from there. I'm like, man, I am not going to be doing the best work of my life in the first few years. It's just going to keep getting better as I get older. So I tried to pace myself, so I really enjoy it. And I love my band. I love them.
And it's so visible. It's so clear that that's true. And you're just putting out love and joy. And it was just really a great pleasure. Boy, and some of the things that you're saying in your songs and that you spoke about in between songs about... looking into pain and seeing healing and looking into the dark and seeing light and looking into ugliness and seeing beauty and having faith. It seems it's the real stuff that your music and that you are made of.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to articulate and shape that experience into words. But the way that you just paraphrase what I said, being able to see beauty and ugliness, being able to see light and dark, I mean, those are all the poetic devices that one can use to describe how you can see the unseen. And I didn't used to be that way. I was like everyone else, just thinking that, you know, I couldn't see the forest for the trees. And now I know, even when I'm staring at one trunk, that there's a whole beautiful forest standing behind it. Well, maybe that's lame too. I don't know how to say it, but the nut of it is trying to articulate faith, that process whereby a person can do the impossible, see the invisible. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, that's where I come from these days.
And it sounds like recognizing the largeness and the love that is bigger than you, this human being, this human mind and human body. There's something larger that's coming through you.
That is my faith. My prayer every day is use me, use me. I know what I would do with my life if I was, you know, running things and planning the show, but time and time, I can't tell you how many times in my life I've had to learn the hard way. I am clearly not in charge. And the best I can hope for is that all the experiences I have, all the opportunities that present themselves to me, even though I may be thinking I'm, you know, creating it or taking it, it's being given to me like a gift. And again, you know, we're trying to articulate that stuff. Life is a gift. And without faith, it's really easy to forget that. And I had just gotten into that very dark place where literally wishing, you know, I had never been born. I couldn't seem to do any good. And to have that go 180 degrees the other way in a very, you know, it wasn't even that hard. It was in a simple, gentle way. I don't know. I just hope people are listening to this and going, oh, Lord, there they go again.
You know, it's interesting because the truth is that a lot of people have prejudices about certain vocabulary, certain ideology, religion, using the word God, using the word Jesus. And people have prejudices about this. And there's actually some good reason for that, I think. Religion has developed into some pretty negative stuff. But the basis of all religions is about truth, and about love, and about compassion, and to a large extent about giving yourself over to this joy that is larger than just us.
Yeah, I mean, there we go. It's something that, you know, you can kind of wander through for many, many years. I mean, the bottom line is, I am a stone-cold Christian, me of all people, you know? And there is a lot of baggage that comes with that particular ideology. And a lot of people try to get around it by just seeing what the good things of Christianity have in common with all the great, you know, spiritual faiths of the world. But I found for me personally, it was very, very, like I say, gentle and natural, the process that took place whereby, you know, I realized, oh my goodness, what are people going to think of this? I just, you know, had to let it go. I just had to figure, well, it wasn't what I would have planned for myself. That's a fact. But at least I had the courage and the integrity when it happened to go with it. And it's leading me some very, very interesting places. Yeah.
Curly-headed baby, my daddy set me down on his knee, saying, son, you go to school, you learn your letters, now don't you be no dusty minor boy like me. Oh, I was born and raised at the mouth of the Hazard Holler, where the coal cars roll and rumble past my door. Now they stand in a rusty row of all empty, because yelling it don't stop here anymore. Well, I used to think my daddy was a black man with script enough to buy the company store, but now he goes to town with empty pockets And Lord, his face is white as the February snow. I was born and raised at the mouth of a hazard holler, where the coal cars rolled and rumbled past my door. But now they stand in a rusty row all empty, because yelling and don't stop here anymore. Temples roar, but God, I wish the grass would turn to money, and then them greenbacks would fill my pockets once more. I was born and raised at the mouth of the hazard holler, where the coal cars rolled and rumbled past my door. But now they stand in a rusty row, all empty, because yelling and don't stop here anymore. Last night I dreamed I went down to the office to get my payday like I'd done before. Them old kudzu vines they was covering over the doorway, there was leaves and grass growing right up to the floor. I was born and raised at the mouth of the hazard holler, where the coal cars rolled and they rumbled past my door. But now they stand in a rusty row of all empties, because the yelling and don't stop here anymore. Because the yelling and don't stop here anymore. Don't stop here anymore.
What do you think the role is of faith or religion or spirituality in social change? And, you know, I think that you had sort of the image of being an activist. And I don't know if you hold that to be true, or someone involved in social change. So I guess I want to know about both those, how you view yourself in terms of a social change person, and what role faith or spirituality plays in that.
That's the most common paradigm that people understand, is either you can be for this world or against this world. And since a lot of Christian ideology has to do with saying this world is not our home, this world is not what matters, it's the next life, a lot of social activists encounter a lot of frustration dealing with, whether it's the Catholic worker sensibility or progressive, liberal minded, you know, kind of charitable faith people. It never seems to reconcile itself with sometimes the very unpleasant and ugly realities of what goes on in social injustices. But what I feel, maybe this is a very personal experience for me and me alone, and I hope I can explain this without it being too digressive, but I got a tour bus this year. It's really made my life a lot better on the road to have a home, you know. And the good side of a tour bus is that you can have a very personalized experience traveling from place to place. The bad part about having a tour bus is it's always breaking down. So imagine about a month ago, the engine completely blew out on my bus, and I was in the middle of nowhere except where a lot of people live, which is to say it broke down in Bristol, Tennessee. Bristol, it's like half Tennessee, half Virginia. And within 10 minutes of the tow truck arriving, I had already been informed that Bristol has a 2% minority rate, right? So I'm like, okay, then. I get the picture. But you know what happens? It's like, I feel for me personally, I am being sown like a seed is sown. And again, like I said, I would not have planned this for myself. But by being willing and open and having the faith that it's not perfectly meaningless what's been changing and going on in my life, it kind of makes sense when I have the luxury of stepping back and looking, because I found myself one Sunday morning accepting an invitation to go with them to the Mount Zion Baptist Church, you know? And I called this one from a mile away. They say 11 a.m. Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in America. So figure this. If all these brotherly loving Christians can't even get it together to break down racism and segregation, what hope do the rest of us heathens have, you know? So that's kind of where I've been walking that line. And for me, the beauty is there is such a wide swath to work. Call it as an activist or as a fellow Christian, I don't really care what you call it, but there is such a wide swath to work when you're walking between worlds, you know, and other people have decided, okay, that's not for me, I'm going to stay around my own kind, people that think like me, dress like me, act like me. But for me, I'm much happier, you know, putting myself in a position where I can see both points of view and maybe be, like I said tonight, you know, I can do a pleasant show. You know, I don't have to be up there spouting out the polemics of this and that, but if he thinks he's going to be declaring war on Iraq without me having a thing to say about it. And I could tell from the audience's response, too. It's like, yeah, we're with you. And so I just have that sense that there's a power, there's a force behind my individual actions, even though on a small scale it looks like what I'm doing is absolutely irreconcilable and ludicrous.
Michelle, what's the story of the cover of Short, Sharp, Shocked?
It was, I like to think, a prototype of the WTO anti-globalization movement, because we were protesting corporations who had contributed to both the Democratic and Republican campaigns in 1984. That photo was taken, of course, in San Francisco, in front of a company owned by Diamond Shamrock, who had, you know, and our criteria wasn't just that they had contributed money to both parties, thereby effectively, you know, buying our democracy, but also that they had profiteered in some way from the Cold War policies that, you know, were going on at the time. So I knew the photo existed because it appeared as the, you know, the photos for the story of the protest that day. It was during the Democratic Convention, and I was, you know, pretty much following the yippie party line, you know. So that's what I was up and about doing back then. And I kind of slept through the Clinton years. I knew going into it, you know, that centrism was gonna be the death of us all, but I had to experience it for myself. So I slept through the Clinton years, and I am slowly waking up from a long sleep and realizing, you know, and I really am grateful for the groundwork that's been laid in that anti-globalization movement, because it's going to give a lot of people a lot of tools to empower themselves in the coming years. Very exciting times.
Lay down your burden. Lay down your care. The Holy Virgin, she's gonna greet you up there with a big can of spray paint, yeah, and a big blank wall. And I can guarantee, yeah, there ain't no cops around at all. Graffiti limbo, where do you go? Graffiti limbo, when there ain't no justice. I only speak for myself, but the word around town is that something's shaking, yeah, in the underground. I only speak for myself, but the word on the street is that the writing's on the wall, yeah, and the cops on the beat. Limbo, where do you go? Drop. Michael Stewart was a young black graffiti artist who was arrested while writing graffiti on a subway wall in New York City. While under arrest, in the presence of 11 white transit cops, Michael Stewart was strangled to death. When his case was heard by the grand jury, you know, not one cop was found guilty. Coroner lost the evidence, and those cops, they're on the streets again.
Hi, this is Michelle Schuck, and you're listening to A Great Leap Forward on Freak Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM.
Oh, you can have your little style war, boys. Yes, and you can keep your little dance. But those crazy riders, they don't stand a ghost of a chance. No, it's call of them cons. That's what Mayor Koch said. He said, call it a crime. And now it's steer clear of the engineer on that midnight special line. Graffiti limbo, where do you go? Graffiti limbo, when there ain't no justice.
September 11th, 2002. Do you have any thoughts about the attacks that happened a year ago and the subsequent bombings by the United States of Afghanistan and all the security measures and the anthrax stuff? And
I really want to get reverent about it, because no one can talk about this stuff no more without being reverent. You know, man, it's like everyone is censoring themselves. But the most pithy thing I heard on the subject, I didn't make this up, but I'm going to pass it along. What happened on September 11th, you can look at it as an act of war or as a crime against humanity. And therein lies the rub. Whichever way you go, whichever road you go down, you're going to enjoy the fruits of that choice. And, you know, obviously I'm inclined and disposed to see it as something that humanity can speak out and address. But I certainly don't give Americans any special privilege. By that I mean folks have been kind of willing to shoulder the idea that we have to sacrifice liberties for securities. And again, this isn't my pithy quote, but those who sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. So, you know, I'm of that ilk. It's probably not surprising. People can probably predict from a mile away how I see these sorts of things. But I just have been reading the no-nonsense guides, and it's really, really given me a really, really succinct and clear understanding of these issues that I couldn't really ever get my brain around. So a lot of it's fresh to me, but it's great stuff. I recommend it highly. The No-Nonsense Guide to Fair Trade, the No-Nonsense Guide to Democracy. I'm going to get the one on climate change. Reading that stuff has really kind of brought me up to speed after a long slumber.
You have a song on your new CD called Forgive to Forget, and at the end it goes, let it go, let it go, let it go. Repeat until it's true. I really, really like that. And the whole idea of forgiveness seems really potent and important.
That's how I see it, John. It's a power. It's a power greater than love. And there has been so much said on the power of love to the point of nausea, you know. Love is a great power, but it, like anything else, you beat it to death and it loses its potency. I think that forgiveness has such an amazing power because it's one that we possess when we're at our weakest, when we've been wronged, hurt, injured, betrayed, let down, disappointed. Our instinct, of course, is to lash out in anger and pain, and it's because we feel so powerless. But I think it's amazing to, and I wrote the song to remind myself, really, because I can't practice what I preach, but it's at that moment when we're at our weakest that we have the choice to exercise a power greater than love. What could be better than that? Forgiveness does not rely on the other person coming to us and saying, I've wronged you, I've caused you injury and pain. Forgiveness calls upon us to recognize the source of peace that is within all of us.
I never knew the origins of the song Amazing Grace, and you mentioned it.
That's a cool story, isn't it? Yeah.
Can you just mention that again?
I think I have to ask him every time.
Oh, the name?
John Newton, I believe, is the man's name, and he was a slave trader, bringing slaves back from Africa. This was in the 1800s. He wanted those, you know, kind of Paul on the road to Damascus experiences, and he turned around and went back. And that song, I think it's amazing that it's such a great folk song. You know, that's why I love gospel music. I say it's the greatest folk music being practiced today. But again, I realize it's got all the baggage that goes with it. But to have that song survive in such a powerful way, and then to have such a powerful genesis to it.
How do you manage to produce and own your own music? Or maybe I should ask, how do other musicians not manage to do that? I don't know which way.
That I hope I can explain this one succinctly, because it's got to do with, I guess, the Western tradition of property rights, that long ago, intellectual property rights were established by creators, writers, photographers, choreographers, etc. But because the technology of recording was relatively new, it established a practice early on in that industry to treat the creators as hired hands, that when they were going in the studio, they weren't creating, they were being told what to create, which isn't true. But it really had to do, once again, with the balance of power over who owned and controlled the technology versus those, you know, being brought to employ it. And I think the biggest problem is that there's never successfully been the ability to create a guild or a union for those particular types of creators. I mean, not literal, because there are, you know, AFTRA is the union for recording and television artists, and there is the Federation of Musicians. But how I chose to approach it when I went into the negotiation was to say that these were my natural resources. I looked at it less as intellectual property than as my natural resources. So having a little bit of political awareness, I basically said, if Brazil hadn't gotten into debt, it wouldn't have then had to subsequently cut down its rainforest, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just didn't take the money. I didn't take the money up front. I said I'd rather have, on the advice of a slightly older artist named Nancy Griffith, I put my stock in ownership of my masters. Now dig this. Here's the real point. These labels, they are so blatant in their abuse of power that even though I had finally, for the first time as an artist, negotiated a contract that was reasonable and fair to artists, they still, 10 years later, came back and employed tactics designed to basically force me to renegotiate the terms that I had, you know. I was perfectly happy with a deal that I had negotiated, but what they did, basically, they wouldn't let me go in and record, but they wouldn't let me leave and go record for anyone else. So they were basically saying, you want a career, you have to play ball our way. And I just stood on the principle. And you know, all I did was stand on the shoulders of artists who had come before me. You know, I'd spent enough time in the Bay Area around the maximum rock and roll scene that I knew going into the... I always thought of it as having worked outside the system and that I was going into the system to try to change the system. I didn't go into the system thinking, oh, well, they're going to be nice and treat me different. I thought, well, I don't know where my battle is going to lie, but I'm going to go in there and find a battle to fight. And, you know, it wasn't what I had planned for myself, but I really think I struck a very, very righteous blow on behalf of the creators, the artists that create music. And whether it'll change in my lifetime or not, but I can tell you this, I helped set a precedent. And I don't know any other artist who's in quite as unique of a position as I am. But let it be said too, I was sort of cocky going in because I had had this phenomena take place where this guy had recorded me on his tape recorder and released it as a record. So the major labels had come knocking on my door. I had never gone to them saying, please, 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 can I create beauty?
Yeah, that's great luck and also great timing and great talent.
You see why I have faith now. It's like, this is a beautiful thing that I can look back on now and say, hey, if I was God, wouldn't this be a cool way to pull this one off? You know, have a little what's that phrase now? A little troublemaker, you know, just sitting in the wings, ready to be pulled out whenever there's things that need to be addressed. Yeah.
Do you get a mixed response when you talk about God or about faith when you go to different towns?
No, because you see how I did it tonight. It's very, very light. It's here, but here's how I compare it. I used to tour with Billy Bragg. Mm-hmm. Now there's a man who had no problem preaching to the converted. Here's my philosophy as a performer. I don't think anything I have to say on a stage is near as important as my ability to draw together a community who is now standing in a common space, looking each other in the eye and saying, oh, is this how you think about something? Well, this is how I think, and sharing their points of view. I don't consider myself necessarily a spokesman, but I am perfectly willing to be the host of a really fun party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you convey more than information or ideas. You're conveying a feeling of joy. And that's actually not something that I think a lot of people that go to venues to see movies or films or dance or theater are going to get in any of those places. Not that often.
Huh, thank God. I'm glad it's somewhat unique, because like I said tonight, I've pretty much determined that I'm otherwise unemployable.
Oh, my. Boy. It's really a pleasure to speak with you, and it was really, really a pleasure to be at this show tonight. I really enjoyed it very, very much, and I hope you come back to Santa Cruz very, very soon with your whole band.
Rock on, man. I'm so pleased to be on Radio Free Santa Cruz.
Reach the scene.